International community is also warning that Lebanon will not receive any kind of aid and financial loans unless it forms a new government that is trusted internally and internationally and is particularly capable of launching the much-needed reform workshop on various levels. Faced with this reality, Prime Minister-designate Saad al-Hariri is between a rock and a hard place. He feels obliged to succumb to external pressure while the internal political demands puts the future of the entire country on the line. A decisive week ahead for Lebanese Prime Minister Saad al-Hariri, he either fails to form a government or he will form one that resembles its predecessors in both form and terms of power and lose all foreign support. Now with us to discuss this issue from Beirut is Dr. Omar Nashebi, who is an academic and a writer. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Nashebi. Now, observers of the Lebanese political dilemma believe that the external influence in the form of continuous U.S. pressure on Lebanon would be the main reason behind why Saad al-Hariri has failed so far to formulate a government, specifically as far as the U.S. openly aiming to limit the representation of Hezbollah and any of their allies at this point in the executive authority and to deny them what they call sensitive ministries, whatever that means. If that's the case, then can we say that actually there's no hope for anyone, even it's Hariri himself, to actually formulate a government in Lebanon with these pressures on the table?
Yes, well, unfortunately, amidst the crisis that we're going through in Lebanon, the economic crisis, the spread of the COVID-19 virus and the port explosion, amidst all this, I feel that, yes, there's a lot of international pressure and international interference in Lebanese affairs. In fact, the only initiative to move forward is a French initiative, not even a local one. And Mr. Hariri was designated as prime minister. He's finding it, he's having a lot of difficulties to form the government because there are demands apparently by foreign powers that are pressuring him not to have, Hezbollah represented in the government. Well, I think that what I heard in the recent days in Beirut is that there is no problem. This issue can be resolved easily. Hezbollah does not have to have ministers from its, party members. As members of parliament, we have to remember that Hezbollah is a party represented in parliament. So many people who voted for Hezbollah are not necessarily Hezbollah party members. Mm-hmm. So there are many supporters of Hezbollah who are not party members and who are not directly linked to Hezbollah, and they can be represented in the government. Now, this is making it more difficult for, some Western powers that are pressuring for, to deprive any representation of anyone who supports the resistance in the government. That's mm-hmm. practically impossible. So yes, there is a problem and there is a complicated situation here. There's a lot of external pressure, and Mr. Hariri perhaps doesn't have the actual power or the position to take a strong stance and refuse these or reject these external pressures on him, apparently.
We would add maybe more a bit to the external U.S. pressure, also to the pressure from the European countries, from the international community, to be honest with you, because they keep pressuring Lebanon, telling them that you will receive no aid, no financial loans whatsoever unless there's a government formed and unless that government is trusted both internally and internationally. I don't know why should be trusted internationally, but in particularly capable of launching what they call the reform workshop on various levels. So it seems like one huge loop of inaction here. I mean, honestly, what options does Saad al-Hariri have at the moment as the country actually is heading to a financial disaster?
Yes, he has one main way to go forward if he wants to go forward or if he has the capacity to go forward, and that's a democratic process. There is a system in Lebanon. There's a constitution. And the prime minister, before forming the government, according to the constitution, has to do consultations with the various political groups and various coalitions in parliament and form the president based on their recommendations. Their recommendations are on the table. He knows the recommendations, and therefore he's supposed to form a government based on the constitution process. If he doesn't do that, he can actually face these European and Western powers by telling them, would you like a democratic process in Lebanon or a dictatorship? Now here is the situation. He puts them on the spot by saying, If you would like to have a democratic process, Hezbollah is a party that was voted in Lebanon democratically.
They were
European observers at that time when the elections took place. So therefore, Hezbollah is a representative of the people. I mean, if you don't like Hezbollah, you have to change people's votes. So maybe you can change the people's choices in the next elections. That's a different process. But
yes,
for now,
they've been doing this the wrong way by sanctioning the entire country. But let us dive a bit into the major internal difficulties here that's happening between certain parties and the Prime Minister designate, especially talking about the struggle between the Future Movement, which is headed by Prime Minister designate Hariri, and the Free Patriotic Movement led by former Minister Jibran Bassir.
Well,
feud about?
Well, I feel part of this kind of confrontation between the Future Movement and the Free Patriotic Movement is about power sharing. I mean, this is what we say in Lebanon, is that the country, one of the biggest flaws in the system, in the government system in this country, is that it's based on power sharing between the various communities, between Sunni Muslims and Maronite Christians and Shia Muslims. And
sectarian power sharing.
And that sectarian religious power sharing does not actually constitute as a solid grounds for building a nation that is capable of having all the mechanisms of accountability activated, because the mechanism of accountability cannot allow some people who are doing corruption to hide behind their confessional identity, and that's what's happening in Lebanon. So they're doing this sharing between the various religious sectarian groups, and that does not build solid grounds for moving forward. I mean, and like Sayyid Abbas Mousawi said in the 90s, when the Taif agreement was passed, Sayyid Abbas Mousawi, who was the martyr,
he warned
that the Taif agreement, since it is based, the constitution amendments that were done in the 90s, since they're based on power sharing by the different religious and sectarian group, they will actually lead to more problems and reach more disagreements between the various
sectarian
groups.
Yes. But one also something that's interesting, that we have less than 2 minutes here, that I heard last week was from the UN Special Coordinator for Lebanon, John Kubis, who lamented the absence of functioning government in the country, especially in the aftermath of the deadly August 4th explosion, but he said that he had briefed the UN Security Council about the lack of progress in Lebanon. I mean, hold on a second. What does he mean? I mean, first of all, in what position is he to start giving such reports to the UNSC? That's one. And number two, is he basically signaling for a possible more role for the UN by the UNIFIL that are on the ground in Lebanon? That's very dangerous.
I don't think so. I think that maybe what we would like him to be meaning, I hope that he means the Security Council Resolution 242, 339, 194. These are Security Council resolutions that have to apply and that Israel has been violating for so long. Israel is the entity that has been violating international law more than any other entity in the whole region. So therefore, to actually talk about Security Council resolution...
What if he means the 1701, though?
Well, yes, let's... Okay, 1701 came
resolution.
After. I think we should go in line. 242, 338, 194 are resolutions that have been violated for more than three decades. So I think it is about time for these resolutions to start applying these resolutions, and then all the other resolutions will follow and it wouldn't be necessary. Actually, I have to say something at the end, is that there wouldn't be any armed resistance if there was no
occupation. And aggression.
Exactly.
We still are not being able to implement the 425 resolution up until now.
425 was applied by the force of the resistance.
Exactly.
According to chapter 7, right
to
resist.
We still have countryside villages that are still occupied. I want to thank you very much for
this very, very
uplifting, first of all, conversation with you, Dr. Omar Nashebi, and hopeful for an upcoming government, if it might be happening in Beirut, to try and salvage what's left of the economy and the financial institutions in the country. Thank you very much for being with us, and please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East stream.
علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of عمل انسان بعد از ایمان.
Self-purification is the most significant factor.
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech from IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Muhammad Ali Javdan. Please stay tuned.
جلوی نماز حضرت حسین علیه السلام وقتی تیر می اومد.
It is narrated that on the day of Ashura, when Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was leading his salah, one of his companions stood in front of him and shielded the Imam against the arrows and spears of the enemy forces. For this companion of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, death was nothing but a sweet pass to the other world. In fact, this companion of the Imam could find mastery over his tabi'a, or natural disposition of himself.
کسی که بر طبیعت باش گذاشته روی طبیعت
This is a power which is given to the faithful men of Allah, the power with which one can control his natural fear of death and sacrifice himself for a higher cause. With such an attitude, this companion of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam acted like a shield for him and never feared the sharp arrows which hit his body. Now, the important lesson from such an attitude is the control over our nature. Great men of God find such a skill and can have control over their natural disposition. In this way, everything except death is in their hands, and they find excellent status both in this world and the hereafter. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Muhammad Ali Javdan. To find out more about this program and our other programs, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care, and goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. Iran Today.
Thank God Corona is kind to kids, relatively, because sanctions aren't. Kids with cancer are dying in Iran from lack of medicine, as mostly adults are dying in their thousands per month from COVID-19. U.S. sanctions are killing people where the coronavirus wouldn't have. Trump's USA tried to blame the pandemic's death toll in Iran on the Iranian government for corruption and incompetence. But that only doubles the sins of the U.S. for both unleashing medical terror on this country and blaming the victim. That's not to say Iran hasn't made its fair share of mistakes, but not much can compare to the toll U.S. sanctions have taken on the economy of this country, and hence the fight on COVID-19. To trace where the blame leads to, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. To go off on a tangent, the U.S. is one to talk about incompetence, with a president or outgoing president prescribing bleach as a corona cure.
Right, and then I see the disinfectant, where it knocks it out in a minute, 1 minute. And is there a way we can do something like that by injection inside or almost a cleaning? Because you see it gets on the lungs and it does a tremendous number of lungs, so it'd be interesting to check that.
Whatever incompetence Iran may have displayed, it pales next to that of the U.S., and Iran is in a quagmire. Maximum pressure economic sanctions cannot not have hit the economy. They have contributed to a drastic currency devaluation and high inflation. But not to tip the scales, let's begin with domestic causes of the disease having peaked in this West Asian state more than in neighboring states. Let's hear it from the dean of a successful hospital in corona care, who also has in his care kids with cancer. That would be Dr. Abul Ghasemi of Baghiatullah Hospital.
The reason for the coronavirus spread in Iran was that we couldn't stop the source at the early stages. The best time to stop the virus from spreading was during the Iranian New Year's holidays. We should have taken more stringent measures like the ones in the Eastern Bloc. The model we chose was unfortunately from the West, and you can see how bad a situation they are in. We need to focus on the carriers of the virus. Testing hospitalized patients doesn't help much. Instead, we should go and test those who are healthy carriers and who have been in contact with them, and then give them facilities so that we can isolate them in hotels, provide them with vacant government houses, and use the money raised by charity to assist them.
Dr. Abul Ghasemi sees sanctions as a blessing as well as a curse. He takes pride in corona-related findings and domestic medicine that were achieved specifically to survive America's maximum pressure campaign. But that does not erase the greater evil.
Handling the coronavirus pandemic is not just a matter of providing medicine, but also a matter directly related to economics. That is, nations that want to control the crisis must have a stronger economy and stronger facilities. And these possibilities have been taken away from us by the West. They do not allow us to sell our oil. They do not allow us to take back the money foreigners owe us. They do not allow us to make our purchase on what we need, all of which have affected our economy.
Dr. Ghani is a lung specialist and on the COVID-19 Studies Committee. You know, the most common grave danger of COVID-19 is the lungs getting severely engaged.
It is true that we are producing diagnostic test kits, but the problem is that the Ministry of Health cannot afford all these kits. I mean, for example, you see some countries that were very strong economically tested one person twice, but we, for example, could test maybe 350 people out of 100,000. So the number of our tests was down because of the financial problems that were imposed on us. This clearly indicates it.
As the coronavirus made it to its first birthday mid-November, it left in its wake the highest number of casualties Iran has yet seen. And from Saturday, the 22nd of November, the nation has gone into a two-week quarantine to be imposed. The government has announced quarantine of sorts in past, but it is not easy to maintain given the strain Iran's incarcerated economy has already endured. In the earlier days of the outbreak, when no one knew what they were facing, the world contributed to exacerbating the problem.
There were other practical mistakes made that don't necessarily relate to our country, but to the whole world. For example, they thought wearing face masks had no effect on curbing the spread. For a while, they said the transmission takes place through surfaces. And then they said for a while that the patients transmitted the virus, but then they realized that it wasn't entirely true, as they were isolated and everyone avoided them. We know today that most people who are infectious are seemingly healthy. Insufficient work was done on the matter, and not enough is being done now either.
In the earlier days of the outbreak, Iranian doctors boasted their success in improvising to help patients overcome the disease. Dr. Salehi, chief of the infectious diseases section of Imam Khomeini Hospital, has visited us again. This time, he laments losing the most patients ever to corona as a third wave of the virus surges on.
Why such fatality with COVID-19? Does it have to do with insufficient government measures or mostly people's non-observance of protocol?
As to why the number of deaths has increased and why the number of critically ill patients is so high, it is certainly due to the high influx of patients into the health system. If we are to assume that, for example, you have the ability to produce 3 TV shows a day, if it grows to 10 programs a day, how much does that impact the quality of your work? The same goes for us. For example, I have the ability to care for 30 patients a day. If this jumps to 90, I can't deal with my patients as carefully as I have to. This has actually happened. The main reason for the decline in the quality of the health system is a sharp increase in the number of patients.
According to official international sources, as of 23rd November 2020, globally, there are about 60 million coronavirus cases, about 1,400,000 deaths, and about 40,800,000 recovered. And in Iran, there are about 855,000 total cases, under 45,000 total deaths, and under 604,000 recovered. Like I said, there's been a surge in cases, and with more cases come more deaths, but also more treated. Treatment remains much the same.
We use antiviral drugs, for example, drugs such as favipiravir, remdesivir, and various other drugs. On the other hand, drugs such as dexamethasone and methylprednisolone are being used and have really helped some patients. But in general, none of these have been miraculous.
First of all, there is really no particular medicine to cure COVID-19, but there are procedures that we prescribe in clinical trials. One of the things we did to treat patients, like plasma therapy, was a project I started at this very hospital, and even the Americans started to adopt plasma therapy 2 or 3 weeks after us. Another important issue in handling COVID-19 patients is our oxygen supply. They even sanctioned us on this and refused to sell us oxygen generators. We started a knowledge-based company ourselves and produced oxygen.
But my question was, can patients get hold of the cure at reasonable prices? Because some hearsay reports paint a dismal picture. In August, the nation was angered by reports contrary to government claims. In April, the Iranian president Hassan Rouhani had said that the government and insurance department would pay 90% of treatment costs for COVID-19, leaving only 10% to citizens. Studies have shown that in private hospitals, the minimum cost of coronavirus treatment reaches 350 million rials. That's approximately $1,370 by the November 23rd exchange rate of 256,000 rials to the dollar. They say those costs can go up to 1.5 billion rials, which is under $5,900. And that is apart from the cost of private nurses and special medication. In public hospitals, on the other hand, treatment for insurance holders is almost free. But without insurance, a patient would have to pay between 50 and 300 million rials for treatment, which is close to $200 to $1,170.
We have a protocol in the scientific committee that you can prescribe certain drugs to people who are admitted. This is clear, so I will not discuss it. When we treat the patient with a scientific protocol, it costs about 5 million 2 months, which is affordable. Also, the insurance pays, and the majority of our patients are insured, and we have a bed for them too. However, some private hospitals perform procedure for the patients that have not been approved by the scientific committee, and the patient is willing to pay any amount in such life and death situations.
Helpful medicine aside, the world is now moving towards using a vaccine. Question is, will Iran make its own vaccine soon enough, because it's among the countries that have been working on it? If not, will Iran be able to place an international order and pay for it? Because we know that even if medicine were totally not under sanctions, banking sanctions have been enough to block Iran's payment channels. Because countries, companies, and banks fear that dealing with Iran would expose them to secondary U.S. sanctions.
Iran prepared itself for both scenarios. If another country could produce the vaccine sooner, we can buy it until our own vaccine can be prepared. But I'm sure that the vaccine projects that we have been working on in Iran are close to the final stage. We do not have a problem in terms of their effectiveness. Our problem is to prepare them for the mass production and shipping stage to be able to use them for ourselves. Several projects that I know of are underway in Iran and have achieved very good results. I think we will definitely have an Iranian vaccine by next year.
We are expecting the COVID vaccine to be mass-produced pretty soon. Would you say that would be a reliable vaccine, and will Iran be able to place an order? Can we pay for it? Do we have the right channels, access to the right channels to pay for it?
Instead of vaccines, I think we should focus on more definitive precautions, such as using face masks, washing hands, and social distancing. The unilateral and irrational U.S. sanctions against Iran and some other countries is another reality we need to face. I am optimistic about these political changes that are taking place in the United States. If Mr. Joe Biden takes the power from Donald Trump and becomes the next U.S. president, it seems that, as he has said in his campaign speeches, he is ready to return to the JCPOA. So I hope we can have vaccines in Iran more easily.
Sanctions are an inseparable part of life to Iranians who have been isolated by Western terms for the past 40 years. But the first hard blow came 10 years ago with nuclear-related economic UN sanctions on this country. In 2015, those were eased and were to be lifted in stages by the JCPOA or nuclear deal in return for Iran limiting its peaceful nuclear program. Iran did so. But come Donald Trump, hopes were shattered for Iran and other parties to the deal. The U.S. unilaterally pulled out and reimposed U.N. sanctions as U.S. sanctions on Iran. Call it illegal to have the U.S. deny it. Before carrying on with sanctions, let's take a look at other media outlets to see what they've got on offer. For that, I give you Shahrzad.
My name is Reza Manucheri, and we'll be reviewing the latest update on sanctions and the coronavirus pandemic, the U.S.'s blatant disregard for human lives. CBS News takes a look inside Iran's harrowing, sanctions-fueled coronavirus catastrophe. Iran is struggling with the worst coronavirus outbreak in the Middle East. Scientists at Tehran's Pasteur Institute are coordinating the national coronavirus testing efforts. Dr. Mostafa Salehi Vaziri's team managed to ramp up from just 10 tests per day to 30,000. It was an impressive improvement, but not enough to get control of the spiraling epidemic. The main hurdle for the lab hasn't been science, but politics. U.S.-led sanctions have choked off Iran's access to foreign-made chemicals and equipment. Vazi has been forced to work with what he's got, which is a shortage of virtually everything. Tehran Times reports 75 lawmakers call on Trump administration to ease sanctions on Iran. Democratic lawmakers have urged the President of the United States to show leniency and allow coronavirus aid to be sent to Iran as the White House drew up a plan to step up sanctions on Iran in the remaining weeks of Donald Trump's first term in office. In a letter to Treasury Secretary and Secretary of State this week, Representative Jesus Choi Garcia and Senator Elizabeth Warren, along with 73 other House and Senate Democrats, called on the Trump administration to issue a worldwide temporary general license that would cover testing kits, respirators, and personal protective equipment needed to combat the COVID-19 pandemic, the Foreign Policy magazine reported. The pandemic has laid bare the ways in which our broad application of sanctions is undermining public health systems, imposing sweeping economic penalties that restrict commerce in the material and equipment necessary to respond to the coronavirus, and harming ordinary people, the lawmakers wrote. In an article by the Middle East Eye, we witness millions of Iranians at risk as U.S. sanctions choke insulin supplies. A new tranche of sanctions imposed by the U.S. on Iran has exacerbated the insulin shortage crisis in the Islamic Republic and boosted its smuggling, patients and doctors told Middle East Eye. Human rights advocates have warned about the devastating consequences of the latest sanctions on the daily lives of Iranians, including blocking their access to essential drugs and food. According to Farza Peyrouyan, the secretary of the National Academy of Health Economics, there are 4.5 million diabetic patients in Iran, 600,000 of whom need a daily insulin shot. That's all for this segment. We'll see you next week.
sanctions had already cost Iran about $200 billion in revenues and helped devalue the currency by half in the past 2 years before the virus emerged. And it was mainly down to decimated oil sales. Modern Iran, after all, has traditionally been an oil economy. So the blow by sanctions, oil sanctions even, to the economy in the medium term, and especially while the country is struggling with a worldwide pandemic, should be obvious.
We are an oil-producing country and we need to sell oil. When they created hurdles for selling our oil, we had only one source to take from, which was the Foreign Exchange Reserve Fund and the money we owed from abroad. So we did not have a growing economy and did not have an economy with enough reserves. Well, to handle the coronavirus outbreak, shutting down the economy is needed. Elsewhere in the world, when they are under total lockdown, the unemployed are backed by insurance and will receive support.
Iran's crude oil sales of 2.5 million barrels per day, the U.S. tried to bring down to zero after pulling out of the JCPOA. That didn't happen, but Iran had to sell by running circles around the U.S., and that was up to only 300,000 to 400,000 barrels a day on a good day.
You said preventative measures such as wearing masks and washing hands were much better. Well, quarantining is one of those measures, isn't it? Why is it that Iran's economy hasn't been able to sustain a systematic, consistent quarantining?
Not only our economy, but also the economies of more developed and strong countries of the world, both in terms of economy and technology, have been unable to bear this. But I do not think we needed a long quarantine period. I think we needed timely quarantine, but not for a long time. We needed to announce lockdowns and eventually lift the restrictions carefully and with planning, just like what we did in April. Back then, Iran managed to rein in on new daily infections by imposing severe restrictions for 2 weeks, taking new cases to less than 100 people a day. But that plan was abandoned shortly after. As a result, unfortunately, we entered the second wave.
Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif tweeted that the U.S. had moved from economic terrorism to medical terror by declining to lift the sanctions after the beginning of the outbreak in Iran in mid-February. He urged the international community to stop aiding war crimes by obeying illegal and immoral sanctions.
Iran's plea for sanctions to be lifted on humanitarian grounds during the outbreak has gained traction globally. But to the U.S., where sanctions failed, the outbreak succeeded. And now's the time to deal Iran that fatal blow while it's still down. To make Iran capitulate to U.S. demands, America not only didn't lift sanctions, but it doubled down, enforcing new sanctions, even as it offered Iran aid to combat the pandemic.
Iran refused the aid, obviously, because in Iran's view, all the U.S. need do is lift sanctions as provided for in the nuclear deal, in which case Iran would need no aid. It could freely buy ventilators and so forth for coronavirus patients from any country it desired.
The bottom line is that the tough economic sanctions that the United States has imposed on our people have definitely affected patients. Acquiring pharmaceutical products and various diagnostic equipment, such as diagnostic kits, and radiological devices such as CT scans, MRI machines, and other equipment that need to be purchased from other countries is another important fact. To a large extent, these unilateral and highly inhumane sanctions seem to have seriously harmed our patients as well.
However much Iran may have suffered, the end result shows yet another failed policy on the part of the U.S.
While the U.S. could achieve some of its goals in short term, that is, it saw the impact of sanctions on Iran. But in the long run, this will be to the detriment of both the United States and its allies, because Tehran chose not to trust them in any way, neither in crisis nor in peace, and to base their trust on its only domestic production. All laws, which were generally import-based, are now moving towards supporting domestic production. Their disadvantage is that, in the long run, they will no longer have a country with a population of 80 million as a market for their goods.
By April, Iran was already losing at least 1 million jobs per month. That's right. And economists said the coronavirus would shrink Iran's GDP, gross domestic product, by a third and create at least a $10 billion budget deficit this year. People are suffering because a government lacking resources can't bail out businesses and can't keep up quarantines because it can't financially support people so that they won't have to go to work. But the country is still standing. And anyone who doesn't believe they can seek corona treatment, just please refer to any of the good doctors and their hospitals, which I just introduced on the show. With the third or latest surge of the coronavirus, I have heard of people spending ₹1 billion on black market drugs and then hospital treatment. Compare that to ₹300 million, which is the maximum standard, more or less, in private hospitals. However, my own friends and one friend in each friend group caught the virus had no such experience. They may have not caught the strongest strain, but the treatment is the same and they got hold of enough drugs to get cured. And those who had to pay didn't have to break the bank. Aye, the greater number of patients treated corresponds with the greater number of cases infected and dead. And with overflowing hospitals and mass graves, doctors will be pleading for medical supplies, although they shouldn't have to, as under international law, a country or coalition of states enforcing economic sanctions should consider the impact on the human rights of the affected population, especially regarding their access to goods essential to life, including medicines and food. That's it for today. Thanks for joining us from the whole team. For now, it's bye.
In the limelight. By artificially delaying the industry's inevitable decline at American taxpayers' expense, the U.S. government has made it that much harder to make the necessary transition to clean energy sources, says Brett Wilkins, writer, in an article published under the heading, Time to Cut Dirty Energy Lifeline. Report details how fossil fuel industry feasted on COVID-19 relief programs. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. In a year in which the United States has already suffered 16 climate-driven extreme weather events, causing more than $1 billion in economic damages, and as millions of American workers face loss of essential unemployment benefits due to congressional inaction, a report published recently reveals that the Trump administration has given fossil fuel companies as much as $15.2 billion in direct relief, and tens of billions more indirectly through federal COVID-19 recovery programs since March. The report by Bailout Watch, Public Citizen, and Friends of the Earth, entitled Bailout and Propped Up, tracks taxpayer funds flowing to fossil fuel companies since pandemic-related bailouts began. It found a total of $110 billion in direct and indirect benefits went to 66 companies, including between $10.4 and $15.2 billion in direct disbursements to coal, oil, and gas companies that are largely responsible for the worsening climate emergency. years a breakdown, according to the report. At least $5.5 billion went to 70 money-losing polluters via the Coronavirus Act Relief and Economic Security, that is CARES Act. $582 million in direct subsidized loans were approved for 37 mid-sized fossil fuel and related companies through the Federal Reserve's Main Street Lending Program. $4.3 to $9.1 billion in forgivable loans went to at least 25,931 companies through the Small Business Administration's Paycheck Protection Program. At least 229 oil and gas companies received waivers for fees normally paid to drill on public land, giveaways that cost the government a minimum of $4.5 million in lost revenue, and likely far more. The report found that five fossil fuel companies, Diamondback Energy, EOG Resources, Marathon Petroleum, Phillips 66, and Valero, received more than 10% of the $110 billion in direct benefits, including tax refunds and indirect support through the issuance of bonds, even if they were losing money. Reassured by the Fed's actions, private investors purchased more fossil fuel bonds, generating some $100 billion in additional indirect benefits. When the pandemic hit last spring, President Donald Trump's corporate cronies made sure the fossil fuel industry was able to squeeze whatever favors they could out of the resulting economic rescues, wrote Alan Zibel, research director of Public Citizens Corporate Presidency Project and a co-author of the report. The Biden administration and the next Congress will have a golden opportunity to ensure efforts to rescue the economy no longer benefit the very companies most responsible for the devastation caused by the climate change, he added. Christopher Kubecki, a bailout watch analyst and co-author of the report, added that the fossil fuel industry took advantage of the pandemic to put their hands out for help, escaping a financial mess of their own making. And their allies in the federal government rode to the rescue. By artificially delaying the industry's inevitable decline at taxpayers' expense, the government has made it that much harder to make the necessary transition to clean energy sources, he added. The report comes just after members of Congress headed home on vacation without having passed a new coronavirus relief bill, and as millions of Americans faced the grim prospect of losing essential unemployment benefits as the CARES Act is set to expire at the end of the year. Last week, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez excoriated Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell on the floor of the House of Representatives, accusing him of abandoning American people. While thousands of people in Texas lined up for food lines, hospitals no longer have beds to house the sick, and 30 million Americans are on the brink of eviction, McConnell dismissed the Senate, said Ocasio-Cortez. Every single day when we go back to our communities, people are asking us, where is there going to be help? Is there going to be a second stimulus check? Are we going to get the resources that we need? Climate activists and many economists argue that giving money to those most culpable for carbon emissions is the exact opposite of what governments should be doing. One economist says that instead of selling fossil fuel bonds, governments should be prompting green climate bonds. With a mere fraction of the COVID-19 recovery funds, central banks could support climate protection, wrote World Future Council chief economist Matthias Kroll recently. He continued, "The price for coping with systematically relevant climate crisis appears almost to be a bargain. With a fraction of the funds used to overcome the COVID-19 crisis or the banking crisis of 2008, the central banks could trigger investments in climate protection of a magnitude that would make the 1.5 degrees centigrade target under the Paris Agreement achievable. The central banks would not even need to create additional money for this. It would be sufficient to replace expiring assets from previous purchase programs with new types of green climate bonds." A May 2020 study by the World Future Council estimated the cost of a global climate bailout at a relatively modest $175 million per year, resulting in a one-third reduction in worldwide carbon emissions by the end of the decade. We need to start thinking about how to practically finance a Green New Deal and a swift transition to 100% renewable energy, and central banks should start playing a proactive role, wrote Kroll. Let's treat the climate emergency as what it is, and let's bail out the climate too.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An Introduction to Islamic Lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson: Guidelines for Self-Examination. Dear brothers and sisters, we know our physical being requires maintenance. Similarly, our spiritual existence also requires some maintenance work. And that maintenance cannot be performed without proper examination. Today we're going to provide you with some guidelines for self-examination when it comes to your soul. Well, be intentional. Set aside a specific time to examine your own life. Find a place where you can be alone. Bring a Quran, a pen, and some paper. Expect Allah to show you things that need to be confessed and changed. You may choose to tell a friend or an Islamic scholar that you have set aside time to examine your life. You might ask them to pray for you and commit to share what God has shown you. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when any servant of His turns to Him, He opens up the doors of mercy and He assists and helps them. If you're trying to identify your spiritual illnesses and weaknesses, we all have it, right?
This is where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is going to help you if you are intentional. Number two, be specific. Be specific when evaluating and examining your deeds. Be critical and strict with yourself. Pick on minor things as well. Above all, questions your intentions. Purity of intentions is a prerequisite of spiritual purification. So if you are genuine, if you're being specific, and if you're being tough on yourself, this is certainly going to help you in examining your spiritual being. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing some guidelines for spiritual self-examination. We all need it. Just like we need physical examination, we need spiritual ones. And we gave you two guidelines before the break. Let's move on to the third one. And that is, trust Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. If you're examining yourself for the right reasons, trust Allah and rely on His assistance. He is the one who guides. And remember that He does not leave His servants alone. No matter how sinful you are, no matter how many shortcomings you have, remember that Allah's door of mercy is open for anyone who sincerely repents and turns to Him. So when you're evaluating yourself, when you're examining yourself, make sure that you know that you're dependent on Allah, and He is the one who is going to assist you throughout this process. So this reliance and trust on Allah is very essential for the process. The fourth one is honesty. Brothers and sisters, be honest in your examination. How many times, you know, do we fool ourselves? Think about it, honestly. You know, last thing you want is that you tread on this path of spiritual examination and you start fooling yourself. You start justifying your shortcomings. No, don't do that. Be honest. If you intentionally keep yourself in darkness, remember, no one can pull you out of it. Last but not the least is determination. Well, are you determined for making changes and amends in your life? It is a question you need to ask yourself before you tread on the path of self-examination. Are you ready to drop the questionable habits that you may have? Again, ask yourself these questions and be determined that you are ready and open to make amends and changes in your life. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight. A climate model released by the prestigious scientific publisher Springer Nature offers a roadmap for meeting and surpassing the targets set by the Paris Climate Agreement, showing that we can solve the global climate crisis with currently available technologies and natural climate solutions. The book, titled Achieving the Paris Climate Agreement, was the culmination of a 2-year collaboration with 17 leading scientists at the University of Technology, Sydney, two institutes at the German Aerospace Center.